This is the podcast for August 17th, 2012. It's not safe for work.
Once again, recorded live from America Held Hostage Day 62. Where are the tax returns, Willard? It's the professional left with Driftglass and Blue Gal. Where are those damn tax returns?
Well, he's explained them to you.
Yes.
That should be good enough.
My wife has explained this to you. you said very well that she was acting like the angry principal
who
is just barely holding on to her temper, explaining to some poor dumb parent that no, we're not going to be doing it this way.
Yes, you must eat the foie gras at lunch at her school. So
just shut up and eat your foie gras. But yeah, she's explaining it like as one explains to the help.
Yeah,
that they're being uppity and getting out of line, and they don't seem to understand that you dust the entire room, not just the parts that are exposed.
The napkins must be folded like a swan. Yours look like a duck.
and that little look on her face that, you know, we've gone over this before.
Yes.
You know, during your last employment review, we went over this, and apparently you don't seem to understand that you don't get to see the fucking tax return. And they really don't understand that they're the ones who are having the job interview.
Yes, exactly.
Not us.
Exactly.
We're the this time we're the employer.
Employers. No, we're hiring you. You have to be nice to us.
But don't tell them I'm not going to vote for them. It doesn't matter. They can show me a 1 year of tax returns or 20. I'm never going to vote for them.
Right.
But I insist that they play by the established set of rules. Yeah. And this is really such a stupid mistake. I mean, really, this really does go to your theory that
he doesn't want to be president. I keep saying that, and every week it gets confirmed. And you know, last week, Driftglass, when we recorded last week's podcast, we did not know that Paul Ryan was going to be nominated to be co-president.
No, we didn't realize that.
We were making a joke, but it turned out to be true, and I was wrong. I thought that it wouldn't be Paul Ryan, because I didn't think that Mitt Romney was that much of a risk taker, but it turned out not to be a risk, because apparently Rupert Murdoch made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
That's right.
So.
Yeah. Instead of just that clip from The Godfather with Rafalka's name stamped over the top
over
of the
horse.
Speech.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Do you really want to see it? Do you really want this to happen, Mitt?
Yep.
Yeah. Because Rupert Murdoch runs the party.
Yeah.
You know, that's really not hard. You have to be a really regular Fox viewer to be dumb enough not to know that. But it is a question. I don't think he doesn't want the job. I just think I agree. He wants it handed to him.
Yeah, he doesn't want to apply for it, as you said.
He wants to do whatever he wants and still get it.
Yeah.
And so he's doing whatever he wants, and he's acceding to the demands of his party, like any good business person would. The terms of the takeover of this organization. You know, this is what you have to do for your golden parachute. You have to appoint this lunatic to your – the guy you like, but he's nuts, as your vice president. Okay, that's fine. And here are the positions you will take on various things. Check, 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 check. And he's doing them all. And he's doing them all with no energy, with no expectation of a positive outcome. And he's really just – there. At some point, the number – again, as Sherlock Holmes famously said, in the silver blaze. Everybody knows the expression. Very few know the story it came from, Blue Gal.
Oh.
Once you eliminate the impossible, all you have – what you have left, no matter how improbable, is the truth. There are so many Bush League mistakes, pun intended, being made so quickly by the Romney campaign.
Yep.
So many really staggeringly amazing lies being told back to back to back. And we'll get to the Paul Ryan's gigantic lie that dwarfs everything else that Mitt Romney has ever done. Mm-hmm. In terms of sheer betrayal of your core beliefs and cravenness. Mm-hmm. But he's racking up so many fuck ups and so many errors and so many lies so fast that at some point you have to start asking yourself, as you already have, okay, they can't be this bad by accident.
No. And you know, it's funny you should say that. I was thinking earlier today about the moment at which I realized that Barack Obama, very early on in the campaign last time, was a very serious contender for the presidency, and that this wasn't just the black candidate, you know, that we were going to have up there. was when his website, and this was, I mean, this was before any primaries happened. This was really early on when we were just getting to know who he was. And his website had non-YouTube, individually programmed, embeddable code for all of his videos on his website that bloggers could use to post. Yeah. And they weren't YouTube's, and they were his programmer had gone ahead, made their own videos, and provided people with embeddable code that worked on his website.
It's easy to do.
Well, it is. No, but
easy for the blogger.
Easy for the blogger to put up. Yeah. And I thought, wow, he's for real. Like, he really has professional people reaching out and making it possible for people to promote this campaign in a very competent way. Contrast that with Mitt Romney's vice presidential announcement app, which they didn't use to announce
the vice president.
The vice president. I mean, you were going to be the first to know on your app, you know.
Well, if you've ever worked for a privately held company, a family company, and I have worked for a few family companies, which are all out of business now, which are all run by second, third generation inbred, you know, rich idiots who let consultants come in and just gut the place, which is a different story for a different day. But there is this definite schizophrenic culture where you have some people trying to make the wheels go round and round. They're trying to make the machine operate the way it's supposed to. And those people are sort of technocrats who are saying, but you see, the thing is, you can't spend all the money moving the building 1 foot to the right.
Yep.
Because that's crazy. If you want this enterprise to function, here are the things you have to do. And there are a cadre of people who are usually well paid who are desperately trying to make that happen. And then there's the family who are like, well, fuck that. This is our company. We can do whatever we want. No, fuck you. You don't get to see our tax returns. That's not going to happen. Go away. And what you're seeing playing out, I'm convinced of this, on the national stage is the public display of the conflict between those two cultures inside the Romney campaign. There's the rich, privileged, fuck you, I don't have to do anything I don't want to. Mm-hmm. And the business people and the technocrats who are like, yeah, but you won the nomination. You spent a shitload of money bombing everyone else off the field, and now you're the guy. And here's certain things you have to do. It's like, well, okay, I guess if if I have to do, here's what's the minimum I have to do. You know, what's like his taxes. Yeah. What is the absolute minimum I have to pay in terms of campaign sweat and equity to technically run for president and get myself off the hook for having to make any more effort in this thing? Because fuck this. This is a waste of my time.
I just can't believe that no one considered this 4 years ago. When Romney's known for at least four years, probably longer, that, you know, okay, so we're going to run in 2012. I'm losing to McCain, so we're going to run in 2012. So you bring your money home. If you're already spending millions of your own dollars getting to be president, why not just spend those millions in taxes to make it look good, to scrub what you're, you know, George Willis said this. Why didn't he just fix all this stuff?
3 years ago. Yeah. 4 years. 2 years ago. Yeah. X number of years ago.
Now, maybe couldn't. Maybe all of this amnesty stuff that Lawrence O'Donnell has been talking about happened during that time, and that's the part that he can't talk about. Mm-hmm. Maybe his donations to the church, people suggest that they aren't what he says they are. I kind of doubt that. I think he probably is giving 10% to the Mormons.
Yeah.
But I just think he doesn't want to make any sacrifices to run for president and knows that the outcome of not winning this election is that he's making it easier for the next Mormon to run. Good for him. You know, so he's doing a favor for his church. Yep. And, you know, after November, he gets all of his money and his nice wife, and he's 61. And, you know, he's got the next 30 years to enjoy his grandchildren. And that's, you know, good for him. And he doesn't have to come out as a tax felon. But just to add on to that, I know people. Rachel Maddow's talked a lot this week about Mitt Romney's habit of tax evasion and tax
obsession.
I know people like that. Yeah. It's a hobby to avoid taxes, and they will move, and they will finagle their accounts, and they will hold on to real estate they have no interest in and have never visited, and they'll do whatever it takes to avoid taxes. And it's like a sickness, in my personal opinion.
But, it is, and it's a real thing. It is a real obsessive. There's a dollar out there I could possibly not pay taxes on, and I will devote it. It's obsessive compulsive.
Otherwise, I am denying myself a flow of income toward me, and I can't do that. So it's OCD. You're right. It is.
And once you get it into your head that there's a stain somewhere in the basement that I haven't scrubbed, then by God, you're going to go find that stain. And it really is that way.
Yep.
And the upside for you, if you are a plutocrat, is that that particular obsessive manifestation makes you rich.
Yeah, it does.
It makes you richer and richer and richer. It has real world benefits.
Absolutely.
You know, there's an interview years ago that someone did with Arnold Schwarzenegger and his then wife, or his brand new wife at the time. And he was real clear. He said, no, I succeed because I'm an unbalanced person. Mm-hmm. Because I'm obsessive about what I do. I work out all the time. And I plan very carefully to become an action star. My wife is a very balanced person. She has a normal life. It worked for him because the obsessive interest Arnold chose was of tremendous personal and professional value to him. It wasn't scrubbing, you know, that last stain out of the last corner of the wall. And I think one other thing to consider, and then we shall move on with the rest of our podcast, mm-hmm. is that Sarah Palin was an innovator. She was crazy, and she still is crazy, and it's all performance, and it's all a circus act, and it's a puppet show. But the right has gotten really close, and I mean really, like there's almost no line anymore to being able to put up a trained seal and have it get 45% of the vote.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you're on the right, if you're a regular Fox viewer, you are so completely divorced from reality. You're so completely trained to just regurgitate right-wing talking points. And you saw this. You really saw the minute Mitt Romney decided, screw this, I'm not going to give you any of my tax returns. You saw everybody on the right take up that as if it's a holy cause.
Well, that's what confuses me so much about the Ryan pick, because that is the one thing that was going inevitably to pop the bubble of senior citizens who would watch Fox or, you know, do whatever it took to get the black guy out of the White House. The one thing that was going to snap them to attention is, we're going to cut your Medicare. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in a minute. But it astonishes me that he chose the one person that was going to discuss the program that all but, I think, 10 House Republicans voted against, the Ryan budget.
Yep.
And everybody else voted for it. If you want to kill the House of Representatives, this was the guy to pick. You know?
Well, again, I never underestimate the power of the stupidity of the
Fox. No, I don't either. Sure. And I do think there's a lot of people. I think Shimkus will get reelected no matter what he does.
Yeah.
Because people just vote unconsciously.
And the whole idea of someone voting against their own immediate personal interest is alien to me.
It's called being a West Virginian.
Yeah, exactly.
So it just happens all the time.
Well, there's that, you know, there's that thing that George W. Bush put into his privatization plan for Social Security that we know from reading Al Franken originally comes from Lenin, which is make all the hard stuff happen to everyone under 55.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is what Al Franken talked about. And we heartily recommend The Truth with Jokes. Go read that. In fact, I was thinking we ought to pull that out and read that chapter on Social Security again, because it's absolutely true. And how insulting. I really think that's the most cynical thing anyone has ever done in politics, is say, well, it's not going to affect you because we're only doing this for people under 55, as if no one cares that their children are going to have Medicare or not when they get old.
Well, and it fits directly into that Randite mind.
Yeah,
which
the Wall Street mind too. I'll be gone, you'll be gone, you know.
Yeah, screw everybody but me.
And that's just not the way people in the hinterland think. I really think that's a very cynical, inhuman way to present politics.
And also, in 2010, the Republican Party ran successfully on Barack Obama is going to cut your Medicare.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was almost Swift Boat-ish in that it caught them off guard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was that, are you fucking kidding me? We're taking a lot of money that's being misspent or misallocated or wasted.
Well, and also the deal with hospitals is we're going to take the Medicare payments out and hand back to you everyone who walks into your ER has insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And a primary care physician. So people are not going to be walking into your ER for primary care.
And we're going to close up the donut hole, and we're going to pay for preventive care and all those other things.
And the hospitals
that
are like, yeah, we'll take that deal.
Yeah.
You know, sure.
But that doesn't fit on a bumper sticker.
No, it doesn't.
The black guy wants to get rid of your Medicare.
Fits on a bumper sticker. Because
of death panels and Obamacare. That fits on a bumper sticker. Yeah. And believe me, these people can fit only 12 words in their head at any given time.
Yeah.
And he's cramming a 13th word, and that first one falls out. So, again, this all sort of goes to the general strategy of the election, which is the right knows it has 40 to 45% of the electorate already locked up, which doesn't really matter because, as we've discussed on a number of occasions, elections are not decided by voters, quote unquote. They're decided by small groups of persuadable people in swing districts in a few states.
12
That's
counties
decides
said
election.
Last night on NBC. Yeah. 12 counties decide this election. You know, I also wanted to say I feel very depressed when I think about how much long game politics is going on the right, and that it doesn't matter how much they're spending on voter suppression. If it doesn't work this time, it'll work next time, and they know that. And that just bugs the hell out of me. I mean,
And you know what could solve the voters? You know what can solve a lot of the problems? Really, I am firmly convinced of this. The same thing that helped solve the civil rights, helped turn the argument in civil rights, which is media coverage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The only people who are calling voter suppression, is Rachel Maddow.
Yeah,
And
they did turn around the guy in Ohio. To say, okay, everybody's going to get to vote the same. And you can do it. You can do it.
And you can do it. And Comedy Central, you know, Jon Stewart is very good about this. Mm-hmm. But imagine if on NBC Nightly News, it was an update on the Republican voter suppression efforts in Florida.
Yeah.
If that were the way the story was framed, which is a completely honest and clear statement of the facts. But, of course, we can't do that because both sides, Blue Gal.
Well, and you gotta love the county commissioner, the voting county commissioner guy in Kansas, who's going around with a digital camera to old folks' homes and doing one day turnaround of voter ID for people. I mean, he's one guy, and that's bad. But the NAACP needs to get on that, and I think they are in Philadelphia, but it may not be enough. We'll have to see. I'm depressed about that whole thing.
We just need our own long game, Blue Gal.
We do. I want to congratulate you, Drift Glass. You've had quite a week.
Has been kind of
it's
a good week.
Unbelievable, but not unbelievable. It's well deserved. Drift Glass had artwork featured at Salon.
I did.
That was kind of fun. And then last night. James Walcott at Vanity Fair, who's awesome. He's just awesome anyway. I mean, he's a friend of the podcast and a nice, nice man.
Mm-hmm.
James Walcott at Vanity Fair. And then Jonathan Alter, one of our faves at MSNBC, retweeted your article on Ayn Rand and
Ayn Rand.
And Paul Ryan. And we also want to point everyone to episode 125 of our podcast. If you go to professionalleft.blogspot.com, you can scroll down all of our podcasts. Our podcast from last April, episode 125, was on Paul Ryan and Ayn Rand. And,
it was.
It's pretty amazing that we decided to cover that then, but we knew he wanted to be vice president. We didn't know he'd be so lucky as to be selected as the nominee. But
well, that's the moment when the national spotlight was swung onto him in ways that it really hadn't been before.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'd been the smart guy, which he's not, on the Republican Party.
Well, he's read one book, apparently. So that makes him the smart guy in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, so. and it's the same book I read when I was 17. I know I occasionally pimp my own work here, but it would please me enormously if people who listen to this were to go and read Who is John Galt, my post from yesterday. Because it really is – it's a moment when Paul Ryan actually cuts his own throat in public.
Yep.
He does it in public. He does it on camera. He does it in front of Britt Hume. Britt Hume doesn't seem to realize it. Paul Ryan doesn't seem to realize it. It does play to this idea that the Fox viewer is just – too stupid to realize when they're being, you know, their skulls are being crapped.
Well, you know, and I want to say too, Dirk Les, I think it takes a writer to actually point that out.
Yeah.
The fact that you cannot separate Ayn Rand's novel from her philosophy, as Paul Ryan attempted to do. That is a writerly observation. So,
and it requires some mouse clicking and a little bit of research and some that post took me a day.
Yeah, it did. All day.
The better part of a day.
Yeah.
And I the artifacts, that the errata that were in there when I put it up were the result — this is also very writerly and boring to everyone, I'm sure — of me moving paragraphs around and changing tenses, and occasionally I drop an apostrophe or add a D where there shouldn't be one.
All right.
It was, and I also, and let's not forget
that. Process, Strickland.
I know. When you read that and realize how much effort, how much skull sweat Ayn Rand put into specific section of the book.
Yeah.
She worked on 164-page segment of that book, the crappy part everyone remembers, for years.
Yeah.
For years.
Yeah.
And she did it with one objective in mind. And that objective was the one Paul Ryan pretended he didn't understand, even though he read the book, repeated the book, enjoyed the book, gave it to friends, cited it as the thing he remembers when he's trying to get his cultural bearings and his ideological bearings, gave it away as Christmas presents over and over and over again. One of his favorite books. He gave speeches to the Atlas Society on this one book. And at the same time, looked into the camera with his pretty blue eyes and told Britt Hume he had no idea. I had no idea, Mr. Hume, that that book had anything to do with this atheist philosophy of hers. Bullshit.
Yeah.
Absolute bullshit. That's a bald-faced public lie.
And everyone can question her sanity, but no one can question her intellectuality. I mean, she was a bright, hardworking writer.
She was.
She was a little
She was nuts. And she put a lot of effort to consciously accomplish a specific goal with this one passage from her book. And that's why the writing aspect of it appealed to me.
Yeah.
Because it is a thing you do. It's a construction. You're making something, and you work on it, work on it, work on it until it's sort of what you want. If it's a novel, you work on it for years. If it's a post, you work on it for, you know, half a day or a few hours. But it's an artifact. It's a created thing. And to pretend you don't understand what its intentions were and what it was designed to persuade people to believe in, after you've said it's one of your favorite books and you've read it over and over again, is such – and when you've based your life on this ideology, is such a staggering lie.
Well, as Sandy Underpants said at his blog, he had a picture of Paul Ryan smiling, and he said, "Hey, want to play a game of hypocrite?" I want you to talk for a minute about Plato's noble lie, because you've been talking about that. And
I refuse to. That's the noble lie. No, Plato's noble lie is where you can trace – I really do believe you can trace a lot of what neoconservatives like Bill Kristol and Randite lunatics like Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney and Rupert Murdoch, for that matter. The idea that – Plato's noble lie is the idea that the ruling class – in order to keep a stable society, must often tell lies to the public, useful, noble lies to the public. Mm. And it's okay to do that. And there's some translation about whether it's the heroic myth or whatever. I'm not quite sure what the exact translation is. But it's come to mean that the insider elite at the top of society gets to tell lies to everyone else because the utility of those lies is the value of those lies in keeping society stable and the people quiet and keeping everything orderly outweighs the immorality of doing it. And every time you see David Gregory on television militating for centrism, that's a lie. That's an absolute lie. That's one of the things that Paul Krugman was on about this week was he really went again this week full drift class on a couple of posts this week in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, centrism is just a lie. It's just an it's the result of Beltway media people, reporters, talking heads on camera, desperate to invent a reasonable conservative that they can counterpose and create a center point between.
Which is actually way to the right of center to begin with. To begin with, it is. Yeah.
But the reason they like Paul Ryan is they needed to invent a character that fit their centrist lie. Mm-hmm. And he fit the bill. He's handsome and he's got pretty blue eyes and he talks articulately and he talks as if he knows what he's talking about. And so they plugged him in. But it's a lie. And
he talks, I think he does bring to Romney a sense of niceness, that he's a nice guy.
He's a nice guy.
And of course, that doesn't mean he's an intellectual or that his policies are any good. But he does, like you've said before, batting those pretty blue eyes means you can't be mean to him by disagreeing with his policies.
No. And you can see, you can actually see the noble lie cannot survive in the digital social media age.
Right.
Unless
it's
incredibly well held. And you can actually watch the lie, the big lie, what was thought of, I'm sure, internally as the noble lie of WMD and nuclear weapons as the predicate for going into Iraq. You can actually watch it fall apart. You know, this whole idea that we have to go into this country right now because this guy has got drones that he's going to put on aircraft carriers and he's going to spray anthrax on New York next week and he's got nuclear weapons. He's just inches away from making a nuclear bomb and he's got all these terrifying mobile chemistry labs, all of which was a lie, all of which was a lie. And at the time, the people who were saying it knew it was a lie. They invented it. They went out of their way to find either completely unreliable drunks or liars to tell them the lies they wanted to hear. And then they turned around and told those lies to Judith Miller. And then they went on Meet the Press to say, did you see what happened? Judith Miller said in the New York Times. Of course they knew they were lying. But after it all started to fall apart, you could see them the lie shifted to, well, of course, the proximate cause was WMD. But there were a lot of good reasons to go into Iraq. Freedom, oil.
Saddam Hussein was a bad guy.
He tried to kill my daddy.
Yeah.
And our media, the people who are at the very top of our at the Chris Hayes 1%, tell us lies every day.
Yep.
And the problem they're having right now, and I believe in institutions. I really do. I believe in the stabilizing force of institutions. I believe institutions are important. I believe in a small C conservatism that says change should come only as quickly as it needs to come, that you should really think through things before you try them. You should test them. You should pilot them and so forth. And so in that sense, I do believe in sort of a very ancient form of conservatism that's never been practiced in this country. However, these people are like those pole sitters, like Shipwreck Kelly, the people who used to sit on during the Depression on top of these tall, tall poles on chairs, and people would marvel at the fact they could stay up there. They're sitting at the tops of these very, very unstable institutions. And so every time David Brooks writes another column that's a tissue of lies, what happens nowadays, now that you have comment sections, is his comment section fills up with hundreds of comments, just shredding him. Just absolutely taking them apart. And then you have a little bloggers like me and medium-sized bloggers like Charlie Pierce, who has an actual magazine column and is a professional. And then you have people like Paul Krugman just banging him from all sides. And it doesn't seem to affect him in any way. He just shrugs it off and goes on and writes his next bad column. So they're still trying. The idea is we're still trying to sell you a calming and comforting lie that the left and the right are always to blame.
And there's a market for that, and that's the problem. There's the a market for that.
And there's a market for the fact that Paul Ryan is a reasonable
intellectual, the intellectual of the Republican Party. Yeah.
And the so the effort has shifted from propping the lie up to insulating the people stupid enough to believe it from any exterior stimulus. So that if you're a Fox viewer, you've been trained not to trust anything anyone says except for Sean Hannity. So the noble lie can be any lie now. They can just tell you any crazy shit. Barack Obama wasn't born in America. You'll believe that because you're stupid, because you're brainwashed. He's a Kenyan, you know, communist secret cell. He's an extreme ultra right, left-wing leftist crazy man. He's a Saul Alinsky plotting against you. They can sell you anything you want because the idea of a few noble lies to keep society orderly has been replaced by any fucking lie we want to tell you. And we've dumbed you down like Kentucky is doing with its ACT
test. Yeah.
The object of the exercise is now
a different test. We're just going to write a test that has no science in it. And then we'll pass it.
And then we'll pass that test. And it's flipped around completely. It's no longer that elite lie to keep us, you know, heroic lie to keep us, you know, eyes on the horizon and believing in greater good. It's keep our captive population stupid enough and insulated enough from any outside opinion that we can sell them anything.
But that dovetails very nicely with our pillow talk last night about presuppositions. And I want to bring that up, if you don't mind, right now.
Oh, no. Roll with
it, baby. When the lie, the convenient lie that's being told to you, goes completely against what you already know or what you have already been told. For instance, when the campaign spokesman for Mitt Romney said, you know, if this guy on the ad had been in Massachusetts, he'd have health care because Romney would have given it to him.
What? And then, what'd you say?
And everyone had been told, no, we're not talking about Romney care ever. You know, that doesn't exist. The only thing that exists is big, bad Obamacare, and we have to destroy it because it's destroying America. And then Ann Coulter loses her mind, you know, because the lie isn't being told the right way.
And she loses her mind exactly over that point. Not that it's not true. It's, you forgot to lie.
Yes, exactly. There's no point in us doing this show if she's not going to do the lie right.
Exactly. In front of the audience.
In front of the audience, she says that. But this, we've talked about this before with Huma Abedin, that you know, people knew her. People know her. People have socialized with her. So when Michelle Bachmann says she's infiltrating the State Department for the Muslim Brotherhood, everybody sort of went, huh? And even John McCain and John Boehner had to say, you know, she's a decent person and we don't think this is true. But they haven't read the letter that Michelle Bachmann wrote, so
yeah, we can't really talk
about that. But you know, this is true all along our culture, and you know, I'm not going to sit here and defend Daniel Tosh because he's completely indefensible. But the reason he survived that controversy, with rape jokes, and I actually think that was beneficial that we had that conversation about rape culture because. I do think some people learned something from that experience. But people knew that Daniel Tosh was a sexist asshole. I mean, they've known that and that he hates his audience in stand-up. It's the Don Rickles shtick of I hate you and I'm going to diss you and I'm going to kick you out of my show. He's done that with several audience members, just thrown them out because
that's what you paid for.
You paid for that. Yeah, you paid to be abused. And he does that.
Yeah.
A guy who does that tells a rape joke. I mean, it's sort of, that's who he is.
That's the guy.
It's indefensible. And, you know, I have feelings about that. You can't say that he's, oh, my God, he said that? Really?
What? In each institution, depending on what it is. And it can be, you know, it could be Comedy Central as an institution, or it could be the particular audience. Yeah. But at each institution, there is a norm.
Yeah. And that's why so many comedians came to his defense, was not free speech, not mm-hmm. it was because this is his shtick. And he was in stand up abusing his audience as he does. And the woman in the audience heckled him. And that's what happens then, is he abuses the heckler.
The heckler,
not the woman, not mm-hmm. the... And again, I don't think Tosh's humor is very often defensible at all.
Right.
I get why he made it through that, is because he was not disabusing anyone of who he really was.
Right. And there was a certain baseline. I hate to use that word, baseline. But as long as you act within the normal boundaries of the institution that you're within, and that people will, to defend the structure that you represent, will rush to your defense. That's why people rush to Mohammadine's
exactly.
defense.
Exactly. And that's why no one on the left or even in the center is really shrugging their shoulders about Biden.
Yeah.
Because Biden has a reputation of being long-winded, short on judiciousness in his talking. I remember, Joe Biden was in Springfield, Illinois, when it was announced that he was going to be the vice presidential nominee, as he did when he announced his initial candidacy. Barack Obama came back to Springfield and announced there that this was going to be the vice president. And I was there early because I was actually in the press pool for Crooks and Liars at that time. And there were people milling around going, yeah, he's supposed to show up at 2:30 and he's supposed to be announced and they're going to announce him. And then he's supposed to speak. It's all supposed to be over by 3:15. But, you know, it's Biden. And everybody was making jokes like that. You know, here's the timetable. But it's Biden. And everybody knows that he is what he is. And so for him to make a comment to African Americans that he has marched with, by the way, and go churchy and say, going to put you all in chains, that comment was actually a very churchy sort of preaching comment. Certainly not a racist comment. He was talking to friends of his in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done civil rights marches with these people. So this is not something out of the ordinary for him. And here we go with Paul Ryan. And I really think that no one, I don't understand this, but somehow Romney didn't get it, that everybody's presupposition about Paul Ryan was he's a Medicare killer. And
he wants to kill Granny. He wants to put Granny on an ice floe and shove her out in the ocean.
Yeah. Or at least make her pay $6,800 that she doesn't have a year for her health care.
Which amounts to the same thing.
Same thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't get how Romney missed that. Unless he was just screamed at. Now, that makes sense that, you know, Friday morning, Rupert Murdoch called Romney and just screamed at him and said, you know, you fucking fucker, do this, or we're gonna pull the convention away from you.
Yeah.
You know, in that instance,
we'll drop a house on you.
Yeah.
You're gonna lose. We can wait this out.
Well, they could take the nomination away from him. I mean, that is not beyond Fox's ability to simply say, oh, look, this tax return thing, we just decided he's not qualified. And, you know, they'll find somebody. They'll find somebody to be the savior of the party and pay him enough. Come in and say, yeah.
By the way, one second, there's a little rumbling and rocking on your microphone.
Okay.
Are you moving around?
Yeah, I'm moving my cord here. Okay.
Okay.
I'll stop that. How's that? Okay. Better?
Better, yeah.
Okay. And you were talking about Rahm Emanuel.
Yeah. Rahm Emanuel is sort of the... It falls into this category, but it's your peers' expectations of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember very distinctly my excitement and then my crestfallenness When the announcement went forth that Barack Obama, that Team Obama, that President-elect Obama was going to be looking for people to join his team. And here's the application for employment.
And it turned out you needed a proctology exam to get on board.
Yeah, well,
Have you written anything anywhere online ever?
Yeah. Well, it was exactly.
Provide links.
The first half of that was I can say without fear of contradiction, eminently qualified to work in the Obama administration in any number of capacities.
Yeah. Certainly
my professional resume.
Certainly there's several departments where you would fit right in.
Is absolutely in his wheelhouse, and I have done work that Barack Obama has spoken about in public.
Yeah.
I have participated in things that he actually ran on.
Yeah.
So it's not like I'm a stranger to his agenda. I happen to agree with a great deal of his domestic agenda and think it's awesome and can be an articulate spokesman, an analyst for that. The flip side of it was, have you ever said anything embarrassing or potentially embarrassing for the campaign? Have you ever used a potty mouth word in an email, in a public forum? Now, I'm perfectly happy with everything I've written over the last 7 years.
Well, and it's not like Rahm Emanuel's never used a potty mouth word. He's known for it. That's the point.
That's the
presupposition of Rahm Emanuel is.
You can't get into the Obama administration unless you're squeaky clean unless your name is Rahm Emanuel.
Yeah. Greet the day with fuck you and you're going to be
fuck you,
fine.
You fucking fuckers.
Yeah.
And he'll joke about it. And you can threaten people. And you can come up to them in the congressional shower and shove them around verbally. And you can leave a fish on their door as a threat. And that's just Rahm. Yeah, fuck it. That's just Rahm. Everybody knows Rahm. He does that shit. So Rahm Emanuel can be an abrasive asshole and get to be a congressman, get to work as the not in the White House, as the chief of staff of the president of the United States, and then come back to Chicago and get to be mayor, all with this resume of being saying and doing things that would make me blush if I did them on my blog, Blue Gal. But, the rules for Rahm are not the same as the rules for everyone else. And everyone forgives him because that's the norm that was set for Rahm Emanuel.
Absolutely. And you were going to talk about Adam Curtis, too. I want to make sure we get to that.
Oh, just a very brief mention of sort of the nexus of Paul Ryan, Ayn Rand, and that obsessive thinking, the way that the seduction of that way of thinking. There's a wonderful documentary by the same guy who did The Power of Nightmares and The Century of the Self. Guy named Adam Curtis. It's a really interesting documentary. I have some problems with it. I think our pal Batoccio recommended it to us originally.
Mm-hmm.
But it's called The Trap. And it's about essentially very brilliant, mentally disturbed people, specifically John Nash, who you might remember from A Beautiful Mind, constructing logical game theory explanations for human behavior in order to fit into a Cold War model of mutually assured destruction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Operating on the supposition that if everyone operates exclusively in their own selfish self-interest all the time and tries to undercut each other and screw each other all the time, then this model is the model that will work. That's a really bad summary of it, but that's basically it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an attempt by someone who was brilliant, but way up the hell up on the spectrum, to construct a logical fantasy land where people behaved like robots, where they behaved like perfectly logical, soulless, emotionless robots.
Sounds like John Galt.
Yeah, well, exactly, and that's the construction. That is the seductive lure of objectivism of the Ayn Rand. It's the one I certainly dabbled in when I was much, much, much younger. But it's this illusion that you can simply force the world to be logical as you understand logic to be. But the minute you start becoming a writer or a poet, or you work in the world among other people, or you want to, date women of some kind, or a member of the same sex, if that's your preference, you start to notice that human nature and logic really don't have a lot to do with each other.
Yeah.
There's a lot more going on in the human heart than Ayn Rand was ever able to contemplate. So she constructed this perfectly logical universe of soulless robots bumping into two-dimensional villains, very much like John Nash constructed a theory of Cold War behavior based entirely on everyone always acting selfishly all the time.
Very much like Tom Friedman and David Brooks.
Absolutely.
Organized
absolutely.
Little people on a chessboard to
yes.
make them do
here.
What they want them to do. Actually, I think Ayn Rand is what happens when autism Asperger's happens to women who,
sure.
as you say,
yeah.
grew up under Stalin.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
an interesting mix. We have to stop because I want to thank our middle child, who has been extraordinarily good during the recording of this podcast.
Yes, she has.
She's
yes.
home today. And she's upstairs making art while we record. And she's going to be making an appearance at the end of this podcast. But we do want to thank her for being so good. And we're going to end our podcast today with a lovely, cute, cute letter.
Yes.
Sunday is our first wedding anniversary. Happy anniversary,
yes.
darling. Happy anniversary, darling.
Happy anniversary, darling.
Uh-huh. And we got a letter that's a two-sided letter from a couple. And you're going to read the man's letter, his side of the letter, and I'll read the woman's side. Do you want to go first, or do you want me to go first?
Well, I think ladies first.
Okay.
And if this works, we should take this on Broadway.
And
perhaps
and
call
this is
it,
from,
I don't know.
The wife is HB, and the husband is GB. So, and they write, Dear DG and BG. And this is from HB, who is the wife in this couple. Dear DG and BG, your podcast is both an invigorating and comforting part of our week. The manner in which you seamlessly integrate the personal and political makes the podcast highly meaningful. My husband and I, his letter is on the back. We both wanted equal time. And then she's got a little woman symbol and a smiley face. Spent this last year apart. And listening to your podcast each week helped me to feel at home. As DG often reminds me of my husband, aw, and your warm and loving banter echoes our own. At home now, we use your names like friends. That's like BG says. And share your words with others. You should know that. Thank you for all that you do. Sending warm regards and good vibes to you and your family. Sincerely, HB. And they included a generous contribution. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And you're going to read the other side.
Yes, I am. Yes, yes. I have no idea.
And
how
I love
GB's
the title of
his
letter too.
Yes. Dear DG and BG, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Real Liberalism. Yeah. I can't believe that I've been listening to you for more than a year. I was reminded about that when you mentioned your upcoming anniversary. With my spouse away in Chicago for internship and me here in mid-Missouri, working full-time and going to school full-time, your podcast is a hopeful and witty hour that enables me to regain my sanity, mental floss, if you will. For me, it's like a church service for rational people. This modest contribution is smaller than a tithe of a tithe. That's a very elegant way of putting it, by the way. But I know it will continue to allow you to do the work that is vital to our future, and it's still cheaper for me than a therapist. I'll share with you that we preface statements around our house with, quote, but like Driftglass says, quote, or, quote, just like Blue Gal says. Thanks for making truth more infectious than lies. All the best, GB.
Oh, thank you, guys. That's
a writerly letter.
They're both so sweet. Well, I can see why she says that her husband reminds her of you, because that's the kind of letter. You would write something like tithe of a tithe. So
you can turn a phrase on a lathe, GB. Very good. Nicely done. Nicely done. And thank you very much. And we get lots of stuff like that, short and long.
Yeah, we've gotten some good letters, and we're very appreciative of your letters. You can write to us two ways. One is at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, or at our P.O. Box, which is P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791. You can listen to our podcast for free at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com. We're at our Facebook page, and I'm Frances Langum, L-A-N-G-U-M, on Facebook. If you friend me, I'll friend you back. We're on iTunes and through our fabulous app available at the iTunes Store. We're on Stitcher Radio and we're on Netroots Radio at netrootsradio.blogspot.com. You can contribute to the podcast. Don't forget that our wedding anniversary is this Sunday, and that's the paper anniversary. Paper money as well. It's very much appreciated. There's a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at our P.O. Box, and all of that information is at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com. Every week, we post an internet kitty to our website and Facebook page. This week's internet kitty is Tabby Tabster, and he is a big gray kitty with very sharp eyes, and we thank you for sending those. You can send us your internet kitty at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com. Please put in the subject line of your email, internet kitty, so that we don't lose your internet kitty. There is not a wait list. We don't call it that. We call it a line of succession to be internet kitty. But we will get to every internet kitty that is sent in, we assure you. Feel free to write us. We love, love, love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any address, we reserve the right to read your email on the air unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the internet kitties have gone galt, and they ain't talking.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whine and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
This podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2012, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Now, we have a special guest here on the podcast. This is Middle Child, the artist.
Hi.
You're not in school yet.
Yeah, but first child and third child are.
Yeah, they started school Thursday, right?
Yep, they do.
I'm going to start this, turn the microphone a little bit. So what are you going to do while we're recording the podcast?
I'm going to go upstairs and make my dolls.
This child makes dolls, rag dolls, and they're gorgeous. And you made one that looks like it's from Bangladesh.
Yeah, it's can you get picture on the podcast?
Well, we might put up a picture at my blog.
Okay.
We can do that.
So yeah. Look on Mommy's blog. Look on my Mommy's blog so that you can see the Bangladesh doll.
The Bangladesh doll. We'll put that up. That sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You ready to go? Anything else you want to say?
Please send us cupcakes.